Good morning, everyone. Welcome. We're in our Bereans Bible Institute, module number 6, The Life of Christ. Let's get our Bibles out and turn to Luke chapter 6, please. If you recall, last week we were discussing the part 2 of the portion in John chapter 5 where Jesus was in Jerusalem observing the Passover with his disciples, and he got into a little bit of a ruckus with the scribes and the Pharisees over his authority, over who he claimed to be, over healing on the Sabbath day, and then of course over the question of whether or not he had sufficient witnesses to his authority. You may recall Jesus pointed to John the Baptist. He pointed to his father, was bearing witness, as well as the signs that he did bore witness to who he was. Now, what we want to do is, if you remember, I told you that John chapter 5 intervenes in between the chronology that's laid out for us in Luke chapters 5 and 6. That is, at the end of Luke chapter 5, we had to jump to John chapter 5 to get the fill-in material that was omitted from Luke. And now we're picking up the account in Luke chapter 6. And let's begin reading in verse 1. Now remember, this is what we just read in John 5. All occurred during the time of the Passover while Jesus was in Jerusalem. So Luke picks up the narration in verse 1. Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. Now the first thing we have to do is decide, what does this phrase mean, the second Sabbath after the first? That's not really that good of a translation. Literally from the Greek, it says the second foremost Sabbath. It doesn't have the word after, and it doesn't really have the word first. It just simply means something that is foremost or prominent. And this is a reference to the countdown of Sabbath days that was required by the law of Moses. You may remember that during the Passover time, during the Passover week, because the whole Passover season, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, is a week long. And it starts on a certain date of the month, which could be on any day of the week. It just has to be on the 14th day of the month, Nisan, following the new moon. So it could start, like I said, on any day. But during that week, there is a Sabbath. And then there is the Sunday following the Sabbath is the Feast of First Fruits. That is, which is during the Passover week, that is when the first ripened, a token portion of the ripened barley harvest is brought to the temple before the Lord as a token offering, that God gets his part of the harvest first, and then after the Passover, the people could then partake of the barley harvest as well that was being harvested during that season. Now, when we get here to Luke chapter 6, and he says the second Sabbath after the first, he's talking about that countdown to the day of Pentecost. I want to look at that, what Moses says in the law about this. Let's look at Leviticus chapter 23. And let's read verses 15 and 16. And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, and that was the barley. 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. You shall bring from your dwellings 2 wave loaves and so forth. And this is the day of Pentecost. Pentecost meaning the 50th day, the 50th day after the Sabbath that fell during the Passover week. Now, does anybody know what Pentecost represents? What, you know, like the other festivals, Passover, we know represents the sacrificial death of the Lamb of God, right? During the festival, a lamb was killed, its blood was put on the doorposts and so forth. And the New Testament refers to Christ as our Passover lamb. But does anybody know what the Feast of Pentecost refers to? Remember, before you answer, remember that Jesus died actually on the Passover. That is on the Passover, the week, during the week of the celebration of Passover. He died on the morning following the eating of the Passover lamb, and that whole day from sundown when they began to eat the lamb until sundown the following day is the Passover. So Jesus died on the Passover day. So he, what it represents is significant in the fact that Christ's own sacrifice occurred on that calendar date. But what is it about Pentecost? What occurred on the day of Pentecost? I'm not talking about in Acts chapter 2, much, much later, but on the first Pentecost, what occurred then? Good answer. It was the giving of the law of Moses at Mount Sinai. You remember God called Moses up into the mountain and called out to him to come up, and Moses went up in the mountain and God gave Moses the law. Well, the day that Moses went up into the mountain to receive the law from God was the 50th day after the Sabbath following their departure from Egypt. And now there is a countdown going on here in the Gospels with Jesus and his disciples as they begin the countdown of those Sabbath days until the day of Pentecost. And something very significant is going to happen on the day of Pentecost, which we'll see a little later. But for now, we know that this is Pentecost, or I'm sorry, that it was the countdown to Pentecost because of what it says in verse 1. All right, let's continue reading. It happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. Now, first, when it says his disciples here, it's not talking specifically about the 12. Now, it included the 12, but it's not talking specifically only about the 12. How do we know that? Because as we continue reading farther down in this chapter, we'll see that a little bit later, that in verse 13, it says, when it was day, he called his disciples to himself, using the same phrase, and from them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles. So when it says his apostles in that term, it's talking about, I'm sorry, his disciples. It's talking about the larger group of his followers who were following him from place to place and listening to his teaching, who had believed on him and were learning from him. But from among those, he chose 12. All right, so the crowd that we have traveling through the grain fields, that is the barley fields, with Jesus is larger than just the 12. It's probably much larger than the 12. So when it says that his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands, that is, they took the little barley, I forget what you call them, but they took those things and they rolled them in their hands, which would take the shells off of them. And it would leave grains, and they probably had a pile of grains and maybe some shells there, and they would blow the shells away, and then they would eat the grain. They were hungry. And some of the Pharisees said to them, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" Interesting. They're always trying to accuse Jesus and his disciples. And why was that? Probably to make themselves look better. That's typically what the wicked do. Verse 3. Now let's look at Jesus' defense of his disciples. He defended them in two ways. Number one, look what he says in verse 3. But Jesus answered them and said, "Have you not ever read this, what David did when he was hungry? he and those who were with him, how that he went into the house of God, took and ate the showbread, and also gave some to those with him, which it is not lawful for any but the priest to eat. Now, this is an interesting parallel that Jesus is drawing. There's actually quite a few things that were going on, in Jesus at that moment with Jesus and his disciples that are also true, were also true of David and his little band of soldiers that he had traveling with him. Let's look at this passage of scripture, please. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 21. We're going to read verses 1 through 6. Now David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" Now, the reason why Ahimelech the priest was afraid when David arrived with his men is because this was during the time after David had been anointed king by Samuel secretly. You may remember we talked about this some time ago in one of the previous modules. But Saul had disobeyed God to the point where God just wrote King Saul off. And he said, and he sent Samuel to go to the house of Jesse and to anoint the new king of Israel. And he went through all his sons. You know the story. But it says specifically that when Samuel anointed David to be the new king of Israel, that the Spirit of God that had left Saul because God had given up on him and had rejected him, that the Spirit of God then came upon David from that day on as the anointed king of Israel. Now, the interesting thing is David didn't become king immediately. Even though he had the Spirit of God upon him as the anointed king of Israel, he did not become king. King Saul, who was the former king, who had been rejected by God, sought to kill David. And David collected with himself a group of men who were loyal to him, who followed him everywhere he went. And he had to stay in hiding for quite a long time away from public view, because word would get back to King Saul where David was, and he would send his army down there to kill him and his loyal men. And so David had to flee from place to place. You may remember that for a while he hung out at En Gedi on the Dead Sea. And there's a great deal talked about David fleeing from Saul from place to place. Now look at the similarities between David and Jesus here. David was anointed king, but was not able, it was not time yet for him to assume the throne and reign as king. Jesus was anointed by John the Baptist as the Messiah, the king, the heir of David, the rightful heir to the throne of David. And just as the spirit that had departed from the former leadership of Israel now descended upon Jesus as the Messiah, so also the same was true of David and Saul. Not only that, the former King Saul, who had been cast off by God, was now pursuing David and trying to kill him for a period of time. The same was true of Jesus. The priesthood that had assumed the governing role in Israel had been rejected by God, and they were seeking to kill Jesus. In fact, we saw these statements in John, how they were seeking to kill him. We saw when he went up to Galilee, they sought to kill him. When he went back for the Passover, they sought to kill him. And eventually they did kill him. But you can see there's clearly parallels here. All right, let's continue reading verse 2. So David said to Ahimelech the priest. Now, the reason why in verse 1 Ahimelech is afraid It says Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" Actually, he had his men just outside. But he was afraid because he knew that King Saul wanted to kill him. And so, verse 2, "So David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has ordered me on some business.'" Now, in this particular instance, David is actually lying. He's lying in order to get some food for him and his men. "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you, and I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand and whatever can be found.'" And he wanted all the bread that he could collect from the priest at the temple. "And the priest answered David and said, 'There is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women.' Then David answered the priest and said to him, 'Truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessels this day.' So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the show bread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away." Now, the law of Moses was very clear that this bread, and the reason it's called show bread, was it was on display. There was a table in the tabernacle. I think I said temple earlier, but the temple hadn't been built yet. But there was a tabernacle that Moses had built, and this is what was being used at the time. And there was a table that was made specifically a certain size, and it was in the tabernacle opposite the menorah. And on that table were displayed 12 loaves of bread. And the 12 loaves of bread, one loaf for every tribe of the children of Israel. And the priests were supposed to put that bread out there on display for a certain period of time, and then new bread was to be baked, and that bread was to be taken away, and the new hot bread was to come out and sit out on the table. So there was always, in the tabernacle of God, day after day after day after day, there was always fresh baked bread sitting out on this table as a representation of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so what they did is when the 12 loaves had been sitting there for the correct period of time, then when that bread was removed and it was replaced with new bread, then the bread that was removed was eaten by the priests, and only the priests could eat the bread that had come out of the holy place in the house of God. So so look at what Jesus says here. He points to this episode, and he also notes that it occurred on the Sabbath day, according to the Old Testament passage. Look what he said again, verse 3 of Luke chapter 6. "But Jesus answering them said, 'Have you not read this, what David did when he was hungry, how, and those who were with him, how he went into the house of God and took and ate the showbread, and also gave some to those with him, which it was not lawful for any but the priest to eat?'" Now, what did David do here? You see, he broke the law. If you look at how it's worded in the law of Moses, David, even though he had been anointed the king, it was still not lawful for him to go in and eat the bread, but he did, because him and his men were hungry and they had no other food. Did God judge David for doing that? No, he did not. He did not judge David for doing that. There was no penalty for that, even though it did technically break the law. And what does this show? It shows that the laws that were given by God were given for a particular purpose, but that sometimes there is a greater need or a greater purpose that law has to be set aside temporarily for this particular greater purpose. And that's exactly what it was with David. But the fact that when Jesus he's comparing himself to David here. And remember, we looked at all these parallels between David and Jesus and all that. What is Jesus implying? Look what he says in the next verse. Verse 5. Then he said to them, "The Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath." Now, Lord, King, and Lord are similar terms. The word Lord means master. And a king is a master or a lord over all of his subjects. And Jesus is saying here that the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath. Now, what could that possibly mean? I want you to think about this. What does it mean? What did Jesus mean when he's saying the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath? Did he mean that he could cancel the Sabbath law if he decided to? I think there's something deeper here than just that. Lord of the Sabbath. I want you to take your Bibles and turn with me to Isaiah chapter 9, we'll read verses 6 and 7. You all probably know this prophecy well. I hope you do. This is a prophecy of Jesus. No one doubts that. Verse 6, Isaiah 9, 6. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to order and establish it with judgment and justice, from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." Now, he's talking about the king, the rightful king, who's going to sit upon the throne of David and rule on the throne of David and over David's kingdom, and it will be established with justice and judgment forever. But he says that a child is born, and that this is going to happen to this child that is born. But he gives us a list of names or titles for this child who is going to be born and who is the son of David, is going to sit upon David's throne. And what are these titles? Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, the phrase there, Everlasting Father, in the Greek version of the Old Testament is quite different than what it is here in the Hebrew. Of course, the Hebrew is rather vague, so it could mean what it means in the Septuagint. But the Septuagint is very specific. The Greek version is very specific. It literally says, Father of the coming age. Father of the coming age. Now, when it's talking about Jesus sitting upon the throne of David and reigning over David's kingdom forever with justice and judgment, and it uses as a title, Father of the coming age, it's associating the coming kingdom of Christ when he reigns upon his throne. It's associating that with this title. Now, what did Jesus say back here to Luke? He said to them, "The Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath." Now, is he talking about merely every seventh day of our week? Or is he talking about something much bigger and much greater than that? Isaiah was saying that Christ, that child who is born, that son of David who sits on his throne, will be called the father of the age to come. And if you look in Hebrews chapter 4, we won't go there right now to conserve some time, but if you go in Hebrews chapter 4, it refers to the coming kingdom as the Sabbath rest. It specifically says that when God said in Genesis, he actually quotes Genesis, when God rested on the seventh day. And then in Psalm, I forget which psalm it was, he quotes again, where he talks about entering into his rest. And then the Apostle Paul, as he's writing that, he's quoting these passages, and he says that there is a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And he's talking about the seventh millennium. The seventh millennium, after 6,000 years, this world is going to undergo a dramatic change. Christ is going to return from heaven, and he's going to establish his kingdom on the earth. And for the last 1,000 years, and it's 1,000 years, the book of Revelation defines that period of time when Christ reigns over the nations of the earth as a millennium, 1,000 years, and it is the Sabbath rest, the seventh millennium. And so what Jesus says here in verse 5, he said to them, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath. He is the Son. You know what that's saying essentially is he is the Son of David in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 5 and 6. It's saying he's the one who's going to reign on the throne of David, and that Sabbath, that's the real Sabbath, that Sabbath rest that all God's people are going to enter into. Christ is the Lord of that as well. Now, let's continue reading in verse 6. Now, it happened on another Sabbath. Now, when it says another Sabbath, excuse me, it doesn't just mean any old Sabbath day at some other time, you know, maybe 6 months later or a year later. It's still talking about these foremost Sabbaths that he was referring to in chapter 6, verse 1, when it said, now it happened on the second, and literally the second foremost Sabbath. It's talking about those seven Sabbath days, those 7 weeks that fall between the first one, which is during Passover week, and the last one, after which the next day, the 50th day, is the Feast of Pentecost. So it says, it happened on another Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. Now this was not the second Sabbath. It could have been the third Sabbath, the fourth Sabbath, the fifth Sabbath, the sixth Sabbath. It might have been the seventh Sabbath, but nothing beyond that, okay? On another Sabbath also he entered the synagogue and taught, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and Pharisees watched him closely whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts and said to the man who had the withered hand, arise and stand here. And he arose and stood. And Jesus said to them, I will ask you one thing. And he's not talking to the man who stood. He's talking to the congregation that was seeking to find some reason to accuse him so that they could destroy him. Jesus said to them, I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy? Now, he had just said, just previously, a few weeks earlier, on those who were looking for a reason to kill him, he had just pointed out how that David did something that was far beyond what Jesus did. I mean, all they did was, they're walking in the grain field. They didn't go into the temple and take the holy bread there. They're just out in a grain field that hadn't finished the harvest yet. And, you know, they just took some, his disciples just took some grain, some barley, and did that with it. And they ate, and they were walking along, and they were eating. They were hungry. David did something that was far worse than that from their perspective. And Jesus said David was guiltless in doing what he did. And now, here's Jesus in a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks or so later, in the synagogue. People are still looking to accuse him. And so he didn't have to heal that guy there. You know, this is the thing you have to see about Jesus' ministry as he's interacting with the people, with the miracles and so forth. Quite a few times, Jesus went out of his way to do a miracle on the Sabbath day right in their faces, right in the faces of the people that were trying to accuse him and destroy him. But they were still unable to kill him. They were unable to do it. So here he is. He's going to be right in their faces. He didn't have to heal this guy on the Sabbath day at the synagogue. He could have told the guy, you know what? If you come back tomorrow on Sunday, I'll heal you. But no, right in front of his accusers, here's what he does. Jesus says, I'm going to ask you all one thing. Y'all. He said y'all. All right. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or destroy? And when he had looked around at them all, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Now again, we pointed out before when we were talking about the guy who was healed at the pool of Bethesda, that Jesus didn't actually do any work here, even though he was accused of working. You remember that? Jesus simply said to the man, take up your bed and go home. And the guy got up, he was healed immediately, he took up his bed and he went home, and it was on the Sabbath day. He simply spoke the words. And if you recall, there was a long dialogue after that where Jesus defended himself by saying, the Father is working on the Sabbath day and I'm just cooperating with him. So he basically said, if you're going to accuse me, you better accuse the Father, right? That was essentially what Jesus was saying. Well, he's kind of doing that same thing here. So and when he had looked around at them, he said to the man, stretch out your hand, and he did so. So what did Jesus do? Did he perform some miracle? Did Jesus work on the Sabbath day? He said four words. Stretch out your hand. Now, why is that work when he had been teaching, he had been standing at the podium, if you will. Typically, they had a chair for the teacher to sit in and instruct. But in this particular synagogue, he had been given the right to go ahead and sit in that chair and instruct the people, and he had been teaching in that synagogue. He had been saying a whole lot more words than just that, but he just says to the guy, stretch out your hand. And he did. And he was healed. Who healed him? Again, it was the Father by means of the power of the Holy Spirit. Jesus had the authority to speak the words, and God's power healed that man. But yet these people were so intent on accusing Jesus and finding a reason because of their jealousy to kill him, that to them, that was equivalent to working on the Sabbath, therefore he should be stoned to death. All right, let's look at verse 11. But they were filled with rage and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. What wicked, wicked men. In the synagogue. You know, we see the religious leadership, the hierarchy back in Jerusalem, and here in this particular synagogue, we see this vitriol, this hatred for Jesus, while all in pretense they were going through the motions of religion, going through the motions of, you know, their Sabbath meetings and having a teacher come and instruct the congregation and all that kind of stuff, and they were paying their tithes and doing all the things that the law of Moses commanded them to do, but their hearts were awfully, awfully corrupt. Do you think that situation exists today amongst God's people? See, this was, if you want to call this the church, the typical church in Jesus' day, that's what it was. That's what the synagogue was. In fact, the New Testament refers to our churches as synagogues in James, by the way. So it's the same thing. It's the same thing. So the condition of the synagogues in Jesus' day and the religious leadership in Jesus' day, do you think it's any different with the churches of God, the churches of Christ, the churches that are called by his name today in the last days? Well, I can guarantee you there are many, 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 many modern churches that are just like this synagogue. Just like it. They profess one thing with their mouth, but their hearts are far from God. And we got to make sure that that doesn't describe us as well. Let's continue reading. Verse 12. Now it came to pass in those days. In those days. Now why would it use that phrase, in those days, within those days? Well, what days is the context referring to? It's referring to those 50 days, those 7 weeks. And I submit to you that this was at the very end of those days, or very, very close, within just a few days of the end of those days. And I'll explain to you why that's the case a little later, all right? But here's what happens next. It came to pass in those days that they went out to the mountain to pray. Now notice they're going to a mountain. I want you to remember that we're approaching Pentecost now. Pentecost was the time when Moses was called up into the mountain and God gave Moses his law. Now there, Jesus is going up into a mountain, and there's this big group of followers following him. What the Bible calls disciples are following him. All right. Now Jesus separates himself from the crowd. Verse 12. It came to pass in those days that he went out to a mountain to pray, and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called his disciples to himself. That is the whole group that was up there with him. He called them up to himself to be in his presence. And from them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles. Simon, whom he also named Peter, Andrew his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who also became a traitor. Now, what's Jesus doing? He has a lot of followers, a lot of followers. Some of them are pretty committed. Some of them are not quite all that committed, but they're coming along. But he picked these 12, and it says whom he also named apostles. And what does apostle mean? Apostle is somebody who is to be sent out with a commission. See, Jesus repeatedly said that he was sent by the Father. He came down from heaven, and the Father sent him, and so forth. We see this all through the Gospel of John. But here he's calling 12 men who are his followers, and he names them apostles. That is, he was telling them why he was separating these 12 from the rest of his followers. Because they were going to be apostles. That is, he was going to give them a certain responsibility. He was going to send them out with a certain message to proclaim and to act and speak on Jesus' behalf and by Jesus' own authority. That's the point of doing this. All right. So, but look back at verse 12 before we stop, because we're almost out of time. But before we stop, I want you to notice verse 12. See, Jesus was about to name or to separate these 12 men from the rest of all this big band of disciples that were following him. You may remember that Jesus said that all authority in heaven and earth was given to him in Matthew 28 when he was sending out the 12. But back in John 5 that we went through, 2 weeks ago and last week, Jesus repeatedly referred to the fact that the Father had turned over authority to him. That he had given him the authority to raise the dead. He had given him the authority to even to execute the wicked in the second death. That the Father had placed all that authority in Jesus' hands. And so here we see that Jesus having the authority, Jesus has the authority to name these men as his apostles. Not the Father's apostles, but his apostles, because that requires authority. The Father has given him that authority, and he's got to choose 12 men. out of here, you know, no doubt the Father was in communication with him. And the Father was telling him, you are going to choose 12 of these followers of yours to be your disciples. And so what does Jesus do? He went up, he separated himself in the mountain, and he prayed, and he continued in prayer all night. All night long, he prayed. I mean, what do you think he was praying for? What do you think? Wisdom. That's what I think. Wisdom to choose the right 12 men in accord with the Father's will. And no doubt to pray for those men that he was choosing. See, Jesus was making a very, 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 very important choice at that time. And also in stating that he is going to make these men his apostles, that is, those who are going to go out, and that they would not be failures. And so he prayed all night long. You know, there's some lessons here for us as well, that when we're called upon to make a major decision, a decision that is going to have long-term effects on our relationship with God, long-term effects on our ministry, if we are in ministry, that all-night prayer is probably a good idea. Pleading with God for hour after hour after hour. You know, some of us don't pray enough. Some of us don't pray long enough. Some of us don't pray intensely enough. And we do things without consulting our Father who knows everything. And sometimes it backfires on us. So let's from this lesson, let's take that home with us. How important it is to seek to do the Father's will and to pray for strength, to pray for wisdom, and then to pray for success as well. All right, well, let's close there. And we'll pick up again next time.